Hello, welcome. This is Red Switch, the podcast, episode 6. My name is Bartholomew, and I'm joined here with Adamya.
Hey.
And Oiva.
Moi.
What have you guys been doing this week? What's happened?
Well, I've had the most monumental cold known to man. You know, last week, my uvula, which is the dangly bit at the back of my throat, was about 12 times the size of a normal uvula. But now, you know, it's still there, but I've just got a cold to go with it. So it's been a pretty awesome week.
What is the uvula?
It's like the dangly bit at the back of your throat.
Oh, right, I know.
I've been doing some Googling, yeah.
Yeah. Can you touch that with your...
tongue, yes.
Yeah,
I can. It's on my tongue, like, permanently. That's a good sight, isn't it?
Mm. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
You had some problems with that. You looked like an idiot for, like, an entire week because you had to constantly keep your mouth open.
Yeah.
Just like the stupidest kind of resting bitch face that you could have. That was you the whole time.
And I went to like the doctors and like went to the GPs and she said, yeah, it's a viral infection. And then she gave me antibiotics. She's like, well, it could be bacterial. I was like, well, that's covering all ground. So yeah, it's been a pretty rough week. But otherwise, it's not been too bad. Nothing much has happened really. I mean, yeah, university and life.
Yeah. Whenever anyone asks this question from me, and I'm like, what do you expect me to say? Do you think I'm having this very wild life? This Tuesday, I had a very rare occurrence where my teacher or like lecturer didn't hold his lecture. So I would have had a free day, but instead of not going to his lecture and having a free day in the evening, there was a 3.5 hour lecture held by the same lecturer, and I went there, and that was probably the highlight of my week, having a 3.5 hour lecture instead of one lecture. Yeah.
Why was it 3.5 hours?
So we have this Center for Research of Philosophy and Literature in Warwick, and they gather very nice talks about those two topics. And it's always very interesting. Sometimes the topic is something that I'm actually studying at the moment, and it was exactly that this time, so it was very nice as well.
What kind of stuff was it about?
Sartre, Scheller, these two philosophers, and the consciousness of emotions.
Fair enough. Yeah. You know what I did this week?
What did you do?
I did a bit of an experiment on myself, my own behavior, by making my phone completely black and white. There's a setting, there's a feature on iPhones and I think Android as well, where you can change the colors that your screen shows to being just black and white, where it gets rid of all colors. And I wanted to see what that would be like, because I read somewhere online that someone was advising to do this because they thought it would stop you from going on your phone all the time because it's kind of boring because of the having no colors at all, and that it would then make you more productive or whatever. So I wanted to see, like, okay, what if I sort of aim to make my phone as boring as possible? How will that change my behavior? Whether it made me less productive, I don't think I spent less time on my phone either. I just didn't enjoy the time I spent on my phone as much. Which is just, you know, it's just making my life miserable.
But isn't that the point of this black and white feature, though? Making it more boring?
No, it's meant to, like, make sure, I'm guessing, to reduce... Because you get bored, you don't want to do something that's boring, so you'll go on your phone less, so you won't have any other option to be productive and do some work. But what Bart ended up doing was just being happy with the fact he's getting bored and just sitting on his phone getting bored.
Oh my god.
Well... One thing that did change, it did change the way I use my phone. I was using it more for things where I didn't have to use the screen. I started listening to a lot more podcasts. So this entire week I've been listening to lots of things that are just sound, because I don't actually want to look at the screen anymore. The screen's kind of boring, but then I am using it for things where I don't actually have to look around, where I'm just using it as basically an MP3 player. So that's quite interesting. But whenever I'm watching a video and it's on my phone and I realize, oh, it's black and white, it's a bit boring, I just move to my laptop and watch it on my laptop. So it's not stopping me from watching anything. It's just changing the way I watch it, which is kind of pointless. But Oiva, you did the same thing. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I started using it on Monday, and we're the third week in our first term. So the two first weeks, I had a surge of like productivity, but then I went back to old habits using my phone. So this Monday, you mentioned about this grayscale feature. I was a little skeptical that it won't work, but I tried it. And as of now, I think I reduced using my phone drastically, and I really enjoy that. Like, I'm enjoying being bored, which is quite interesting. So I used to browse online forums, and without color, it's only the text that really interests. And when it's only the text that interests, there's more value to the textual content instead of the image, which are memes.
Yeah.
So I'm really enjoying it. I think I'm going to continue using it.
Do you guys think for something like this, let's say you're trying to get interested into a topic, so let's say you've suddenly, you want to get into a topic, let's say a certain sport, let's say you want to get interested in basketball, and if, for example, you have this black and white feature, do you reckon that will prevent you to getting interested in that topic, reading stuff about it, because you just get bored, all you'll have is like text. So for example, I'm trying to get into like the financial market. And in that, you have to watch a lot of videos and like actually, and it is kind of boring at points, but the fact is color, and there's, you know, a lot of other things other than just black and white that keeps me kind of going and watching the next video.
But so would you say that having color is a really big impact on maybe your attention?
Yeah, I think black and white just makes everything a little bit more dull, and like, it gives it like a slight undertone that's like in your subconscious that you don't want to watch another black and white video.
Yeah, that, I think that must be like exactly the point. Like visual impressions of some topics when even in teaching is crucial to keeping that attention. Like obviously if it's more tedious, you wouldn't be so keen on following that.
So you can look at the same thing as sort of what people always say about all sorts of things, is that you have to do it in moderation, that makes it more enjoyable. If you've got sort of your favorite food is chocolate and you eat chocolate all the time, then you no longer like it after a while because you're too used to it. If you take something in moderation, it's much more enjoyable. And I am noticing that if I have spent most of my time looking at black and white screens for the day, and then I end up at the end of the day watching a video that's in full color, that I am kind of in amazement from it, or I really like the look of it, or I've found myself looking at the sort of the sunset more often, thinking, wow, that's a really nice shade of blue, or that's a really nice sunset, because I'm not seeing those same colors on my phone screen. And I do think that adds a bit, because then whenever I do see color, it is much more of an enjoyable thing. It's not just thrown around that everywhere I go, I see bright colors.
Do you reckon to be a bit more clever about it, you should have almost like an hour or 2 hours where you allow yourself to put your phone back into the color mode where you want it, like almost like at the end of the day when you've done your tasks and done your work, you can go on your phone and enjoy that. And you that way you'll really almost like give present yourself, and like, it'll be like an incentive at the end of the day when you've done the work that you can now turn it on, as in terms of phone, not turn it on in any other way, but like turn on your phone and put in the color mode and actually watch a video or, you know, browse it and actually feel happy about it and enjoy those little details, which will make it a lot more enjoyable. And then turn it black and white again, next day, you do your work and then...
My workout routine has... use that method, like it's a reward method. So I instead of prolonging and procrastinating my work towards the last possible moment of making it, I usually reward myself. It sounds weird. Reward myself by doing it immediately and then having the good rush of emotion that I've actually already done it. And then I'm having a long period of time when I don't feel stressed about it anymore. And I already think about that ahead in time when I attempt to do something at the first possible moment of doing it. So back in the high school, when I only had very easy homework of mathematics, I would just do it the first moment I got back home, and then the rest of the day I would reward myself with like playing video games or doing whatever I like. So yeah, I think that would probably work.
How do you get onto the black and white screen?
Okay, so on an iPhone, you go to settings.
Yeah.
Then you go to general.
Yeah.
Accessibility.
Yeah.
Color filters, I think.
I'm looking for it now.
Color accommodations. Display accommodations.
Yeah.
And then in there's color filter. And you can set on the black and white color filter. It's quite tricky to find, but it's, you know, it's explained very well if you just Google it.
Yeah.
What I noticed, as well as sort of behavioral changes of mine or how color may have been affecting me by having it constantly, is also what goes into the interface design, the graphic design of the apps I use and the way I use my phone. There are certain things in color theory that are kind of abused by graphic designers because they're so effective. One thing that remains a very effective, very interesting fact is how our eyes and how we respond to the color red. The color red is by far one of the most most effective colors at directing our attention.
Mm.
It's been shown that red objects or text on red backgrounds or red text itself, all of these things draw our attention away from anything else and show up more sharply, like literally more sharply on our vision than if it were not red. We're attracted to this color, and that's why, you know, yeah.
Isn't it because I've heard this actually before, where if when you walk into a room, the first color your eyes actually register, like, this is like obviously like the time frames when you're tiny, is actually red. So the first color you actually see is red. So that probably does explain.
It's crazy. And we also associate culturally a lot of things with the color red.
Yeah.
You've got blood, which is red. You've got aggression. You've got anger. All of these things are associated with red. But also passion and love and sort of intense emotion. Red comes in, sort of is a color that's tightly bound to that meaning. And sort of the design of apps and the design of our phones, sort of they use that fact. You've got little notifications that show up on the home screen on top of apps, little circular red dots with a one or a two in it for two unread messages. They're red for a reason because that attracts so much attention.
Mm.
And what I saw when I set my phone to grayscale is how much less they show up. I have to really look around the screen to then see those bubbles. They don't sort of draw my attention to those bubbles as much because, you know, that color was the color was a vital part of it.
Yeah, this goes way back, doesn't it? Like graphical user interfaces that computers use in the modern day are defined with colors to please the user. Like when I was 5 years old, I remember we used to play on an old Windows, didn't have anything else but the text-based comment prompt. And that's not very pleasing to the eye unless you're a font designer or something like
So it was just sort of MS-DOS. Yeah, it was just the black text.
And then what really pleased the eye was eventually playing the video games. So I used to play Bubble Bobble, which is a very beautiful little game, an arcade game as well. And then also Kirby. And Kirby is actually red. Just by the way.
wasn't there a guy, I think I was watching the video, you showed me the video, but where there was, he was like colorblind, but he only saw things in black and white, and he had like this camera.
Yeah.
And it made like he had like a little camera that was connected to his brain, and it created a sound just so he could experience color, which I find is quite interesting, because do you reckon he was more productive than any other person? Because technically he can literally switch it off, like his phone, he can turn his setting off and just see everything in black and white.
Yeah, so the context here is that there's this guy who was completely colorblind. You've got various versions of colorblindness where it's a single color which you can't distinguish from another. He was entirely colorblind.
Mm.
It was grayscale. And he had a little sort of cyborg thing connected to the back of his skull so that he could pick it up as sound, where colors were turned into vibrations. And after a month of practicing with this, he was able to distinguish between all of those cuts, those sounds, and see color or hear color.
Yeah, that's amazing. What I would want to mention though, grayscaling your phone does not suddenly change you into a full blown academic. You really have to apply yourself. So it's not a one click like a mystery pill or whatever to change your all of your habits, but it does help with addiction because you won't be as keen on going on phone if it's not going to emotionally affect you as strongly as it used to.
Yeah, exactly. But beside from that, there were also some other things I discovered whilst researching more about this, about color and how color is used in design. There are some really interesting things about how color is very relative in terms of culture or in linguistics. Color is defined differently in different languages. Mm. For example, in Vietnamese, blue and green are two shades of the same exact color. They're not seen as two different colors. So what we define as two different colors, and we think of them in a different way, we've got green grass and blue sky, they think those are two different shades of one similar color.
Mm.
It's really interesting. We have the same, or for example, an even more interesting one is perhaps how in Russian, and maybe that's also in Finnish, that light blue and dark blue are two different colors. So for us, there's a light shade of blue and a dark shade of blue, but in Russian, they're two completely different colors. Just like we have pink and red, where pink is actually just a light shade of red, where we just sort of consider that a completely different color.
Vietnam as a country has a lot of like forests and stuff like that. Do you reckon the reason why they've done it like green and blue are just two different shades is because that's nature, green and blue skies? So I reckon, and water, because there's a lot of rain there. So it's not a lot of like sort of deserts, is it?
Cultural
evolution, where they just teach the children like that's the color of nature, if you like.
They are both part of the so-called cool colors group, and maybe their grouping of colors came more from a looking at cool and warm colors, a distinguishing between those two, than sort of getting the color wheel and splitting it up into six pieces. It might be just how they came up with it is different.
Okay, if we go into the shades, I also noticed this when I was trying the grayscale, that you start to pick up more of shades of gray, because obviously it's not just black and white, it's everything in between. And that has a lot to do with shadows and if you ever start practicing like art, you start with the shades and using mainly black and white for your colors.
It's funny that when I remove color from my phone screen, I'm suddenly realizing a lot more, learning a lot more about color, because I'm seeing the world as it is without all of this color being used. And so there are lots of other places where we might be able to apply this, where we remove something that we're so used to, and that would inform us about that thing we just got rid of. That it would inform us about how that thing was affecting our minds or our behavior, or how we see the world because we're already always surrounded by it. You could maybe do the same by shutting off technology completely and seeing how that changes you. There's tons of more experiments that can be done in a similar vein that can all inform us or make us understand a bit more about the things that are constantly affecting us. Should we talk about something else?
Man.
I'm not usually a good presenter. Like in my high school, I would just talk about something and I would get very shaky.
And, are you getting shaky now? Is there pressure?
A little bit. So instead of immediately going to the topic, I think we should discuss.
Okay.
I have always been enjoying conversations. So I really enjoy conversations, and I'm kind of like a conversational conversational guy. I think conversations go a long way in gaining information and learning, and it can be a very, very good experience between just two people. It can be personal and get very, what's the word?
Deep?
Deep, yes. No.
If anything, that's why we started this podcast. Yeah. Because we all have some appreciation for conversation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I started this podcast with you. And I think then we got Tadamia with us. And also Suresh, but Suresh is out now. And I thought I would enjoy doing this podcast, which I am doing, because of having conversations. And one thing I always want to improve in is conversations, because I think it's a very crucial and central thing in my life. So I've been thinking about conversational styles this week. And
which means?
Personally, before coming here, I didn't really have a big idea of what conversations are going to be like and whether or not I will be audited by British people about the British politics and I have to have an enormous amount of information or like knowledge about the British politics, which I still don't have. But that was completely wrong. I haven't met almost anyone who's been exquisitely talking about the English politics. That's good. I would have sucked at that. So I was a little stressed about that as well before coming here. And what I eventually did find out was that English people, in my mind, in my personal experience, have a different take on having conversations. I heard this analogy from another Finnish person who's been experiencing the same thing. Back in Finland, we use this bowling alley method where one person is listening and does not use like little redundant phrases like yeah, I think so too, I think you're right. Instead, Finnish people just like and they listen very deeply, and it can go like many minutes before the other person even says anything. So the bowling alley method is where you just prepare your own mind and you really go in there and you're trying to strike the conversation and your own opinion on the other person. And I think that is a good thing, and there might be some positives in that. And then the English version would be this tennis alley court. No, not tennis alley court. Tennis court, yeah, exactly. So it's more like even a contact sport where you just bounce ideas, and whenever you say something, the other person feels obliged to immediately respond, and there's no awkward silences where the other one is trying to form their idea better, to think more thoroughly what they want to say, what they want to maybe argue even. It's not necessarily only about arguments, but it's where English people will use those sort of redundant phrases where they just say, yeah, I think you're right. And they might not even think that's right. So that might be a negative there. And this week, I kind of got upset about this one term, triggered, one could say, about mansplaining. So I read this article of some feminists who was reading about some sociology research about men being more prevalent to explaining things and explaining in minute detail something that's not necessary to the topic at hand. And that sort of sounds like the bowling alley analogy I had. Like some Finnish guy might just be talking hours on end, even just lecturing on one thing, and that would be called mansplaining. But it's in some ways I didn't like this term because it used the man, and it's very gendered. And if these feminists really are true to their beliefs, then they might not want to genderize this, because I think that conversational topics or like styles can be possessed by different genders, definitely. And What I understood was that male conversation style is this influence based, and they want to have a power relation or something, and the female one would be like more like linking words and terms and trying to bring out the other person to the conversation as well. But I think everyone does this, actually. And that's what I noticed, that coming to England, I think people were using maybe these linking words more. And it really differed, and it didn't have anything to do with the gender. It's more like,
When you're talking about this bowling alley and tennis court analogy, the thing of mine that comes to mind is not necessarily this difference in that English people use a lot of these words to kind of inform the person talking that they're still listening. What comes to mind to me is the big difference in interruption, that it's perfectly fine for maybe two Finnish people, for one to talk a long time and the other to listen and wait for that person to finish talking before interjecting, whilst English people might just want to, as soon as they have something to add to the conversation, not even allowing the other person to finish their sentence yet, to want to interrupt and immediately get their voice in there. That we're listening in order to be able to respond, not listening in order to be able to understand. We're always listening and thinking, how can I respond to this, or what can I add to this? And I noticed that right now for me, whilst listening to you talk, I was thinking, okay, how can I add to this, or what can I say, or what? It's constantly, there may be a pressure to keep the conversation going, not so much just to think about the topic at hand, and if there's nothing left to say, leave nothing to say. There's always this idea that I have to say something. Maybe that's a big difference. Maybe that's where it comes from.
Yeah. In the article that I read from the feminist, they mentioned this as an issue when somebody asks something from a guy, and this guy, instead of answering it in a thorough one, cut to the chase, point like sentence, they will go on with like tedious paragraphs on some topic that they find interesting. And after 5 minutes, they might not even be able to answer it. And then instead of doing that, they should think back, did I actually answer the question? That would be very crucial. Yep.
It's quite interesting because you talk about, you know, the fact that there's in Finland there's sort of the way that someone goes into a monologue and then they stop talking and then someone else goes into a monologue. In India and like in certain Asian countries, it depends a lot on your social standing and your knowledge itself. So if you watch like a news program in India, like in India, what you'll see, you know, like the big debates, two people, when they are similar social standing, they will just shout at the exact same time their own views upon. There won't be like a balanced argument where so it's like there's two tennis balls in that tennis court,
so it becomes a cacophone. Like,
yeah, it's like both of them are shouting, so it's just like, oh my god, like who do you listen to? And when there is a person that's got a higher social standing, he talks out, another person listens, and when he starts talking, this guy, the guy with the social standing, can interrupt at any point and be like, no, that's wrong. And the other guys have to be quiet. So it's kind of interesting how someone's social standing within the society can affect their own conversation style. So when if the two people are the same social standing, they both just shout. So it's almost like a tennis match, but with two tennis balls. They're all just like playing with like their own tennis ball and having a good time. It does not matter what the other person thinks. It's just what I want to get my point across. Doesn't matter if he's shouting or he's not talking. But when there is a difference in social standing, one person is dominating the other person in terms of the conversation. It doesn't matter what the person thinks, he can interrupt at any point saying, no, you're wrong, and this is why. And he can't be like, no, because he's like, no, I'm more knowledgeable than you. Look where you are and look where I am.
Yeah, social standing has a very important aspect in this. And one point they made in the article was exactly the education and maybe this patriarchy thing where men have always had more power over others, especially in like families. Under the same roof, there's one man, one woman, and then the children. The man is always used to be the more powerful one, and then they had a bigger, like they had more power to talk. And then my lecturer this week mentioned this thing. If you look at prime ministers in England who come from the Eton College, when they talk, they have extremely good oratorical skills. So when they talk, they won't hum between the speaking. Like they won't say...
Queen's English, really.
Yeah, yeah. And
yeah, it's perfectly well spoken.
So, love it.
I think that just goes to education. If you have education, like in England, I assume there might be still some issues with having equalized education between even schools and even genders. Back in Finland, that's not the case, where everyone has to have the same education. You're not even allowed to have differing educations because it's against the constitution. So everyone has exactly the same curriculum. There's no private schools. Women are even more prevalent doing university degrees. Women are even higher up the social status. They have a higher amount of pay. Like it's, I think it's like 52 cents per woman and 48 cents for men in Finland in the statistics. So I don't think this is just a gender issue. It's more like education issue. And sociologically, if you want to change it, I think it's most crucial to change the education of the students.
And so this article took a different stance on it, that it was a matter of gender.
I think it was unnecessarily man-bashing. Like if feminists sometimes have this issue that they're not talking about gender equality, they're talking about females bashing males to get themselves up. I don't want to go too much into that. I believe there are different contemporary issues in feminism in different countries, and gender equality can be thought as differently by a Finnish person as an English person.
There are more valid and less valid issues to discuss.
Yeah.
And this mansplaining one, would you say that this one is less valid? Is a non-issue, as it were?
It's not a non-issue, but it's unnecessarily bashing towards one gender. But going further away from that, because I don't want to delve into the mansplaining term itself. There is another article I read about four different conversational styles that people use, and they have nothing to do with gender. And I can talk about those in detail. Adamian?
Talking about the whole, like, the two different types, or four different types, but, like, the two different types we've been discussing, where it's either waiting for some person to finish and then adding in. And you talked about Eton College sort of students and, like, students of private who are privately educated. And it's almost considered rude if you do interrupt someone, and here anyway, in the UK, if you do interrupt someone and, you know, sometimes they're like, you know, you don't let the person finish. It's kind of interesting how the less English you get, so as in like what you've experienced is a lot of people do interrupt a lot, and there's a lot more back and forth. But if you look at the parliament, and like there's a lot of more monologue kind of system where one person gives out their idea, the other person waits and listen, and then, you know, he answers back. Do you reckon the more English you are, kind of the more rude you get? Because the more back and forth the conversation is, the less the person thinks the conversation's actually taking place at the moment. It's just like you're just getting your point across and you're not actually listening to the other person. Whereas when you listen to a monologue, you can really take take what he's said in and then come up with your own argument. Whereas when it's a tennis match, sometimes a player's playing his own game and he doesn't really have time to think about what the other person's doing. It's almost a reactive thing. So, yeah.
Well, even in that analogy, it would be good for the tennis player to be able to know what the other person is thinking. So yes, I definitely do think you should always consider what the other person might have to say. So when I'm talking with someone else, I will first want to say very quickly my point, and if they have something to say that about that, I'll be all ears, because that way I can assess and qualify my own argument in the topic better. I mean, what is even the point of just getting through your own opinion to someone else?
Well, it's the whole idea of, like, you've got two ears and one mouth, and you should be doing twice as much listening as talking. And that's like a common thing people say here, and especially teachers, and they talk a lot, really. So
It's always coming from the people that really like the sound of their
voice. It's also like the presidential debate that's been going on, and when you have Hillary versus Trump, and I don't want to get too much into the political side, but when they're having a conversation, you have one person that talks for ages and the other person talks for ages again. And they're normally don't interrupt apart from Trump sometimes going,
Trump constantly, wrong.
And I find that quite interesting how Trump normally does address what Hillary says. So when Hillary says something about Trump, Trump says, no, this is why it's wrong. And Hillary just completely ignores what Trump has said and just has her own thing. So it's almost like
She has one connecting statement of that is lies or that's not true.
Yeah.
And then she continues
Which is why I find the presidential debate kind of annoying, because it's not really a debate. It's almost like a speech, but a speech broken into. Like, Hillary's got a speech, Trump has got a speech, and it's like, they kind of merged it together where it's not linked at all, and sometimes like, oh, this is me. And in order to like basically just say that's wrong or that's not true, and then they just go into their own thing, which is what I find annoying. So
yes,
that's an example of a bad conversation style when there is no debate going on. It's just a speech really at the end of the day.
Anyone wanting a prime example of bad conversationalist is Trump. Exactly. Like, if some interviewers ask what do you think we should do about the American way of life? Trump answers, yes, the American way of life is in such big problems. We have a big problem in hand, and there's troubles in the American way of life. The American way of life has to be brought back. And not answering the question, how are you bringing back the American way of life? He's just stating this thing the interview said and not responding to that at all. But I'll go to the four different styles of conversational styles that I found. It was a Forbes article, and this has nothing to do with gender now. So there was four different types: intuitive, analytical, and functional and personal conversational styles. So people have like maybe one standard conversational style that they use the most, not because they think that's the best way and should use it, but just because they come naturally to them. And learning about these four different conversational styles definitely help in a lot of different situations of life, and especially in being very employable as well. So knowing how to get your point through in different conversations can be hugely beneficial to your work status. So I'll just go straight into what the four different are. I'm just going to make like three different points of what they have. So intuitive conversation style is this big picture person who has like enjoys going straight to the end point and having big picture connections.
So it's like a Trump person. No details, just this.
Yeah, exactly. Very impatient, not interested in the minute details, gets bored, tires down and can't listen to lectures, for instance, will sleep there. I personally might think I'm an intuitive type, but I definitely do want to learn about the other types, and I've always been keen on learning those other types as well. But yeah, getting further. The analytical type is thought as maybe cold and more into the minute details. So these people will be precise in asking the details. Somebody says something like, well, let's say some political fact, and then this person comes in and says, that's not true, or where is your sources, are you sure that's the right fact? And they'll really precise pressure on precise details.
This reminds me of the one person who comes to mind that to me fits that is Sam Harris. We discussed one of his talks on an episode a while ago, and he's whenever in a interview he gets the question at hand and really deconstructs it and treads very lightly around the topic to make sure that no detail goes amiss and that it's not, that his words are not misinterpreted. And this is a result of him having quite extreme views, granted.
Yes.
So he has to be very safe with his words. But he has this incredibly detailed and an interesting way of talking, that he makes sure that it's almost impossible to misinterpret what he's saying. And that's that to me, that would be a good example of an analytical voice or an analytical speaker.
Well, yes, analytical people are cold, and they might feel to some people who are like more feeler, emotional based, that they don't have emotions. And I personally enjoy having conversations with analytical people when I want to have a thorough conversation where we press on defining the same terms, thinking the same things, and that way bringing our kind of like own mind to the hive. Okay, and then there's the third type, like functional. So functional type is a good lecturer, I think. They have a whole picture at the same time as they give step by step detailed information, like minute details about the thing. So they won't go straight into the end point. They'll build up to that very bit by bit. And this can get very tedious. As I said, it's a good lecturer, but if somebody is not interested in lectures, let's say this intuitive person, they will get bored and then they will fall asleep. And that's not the way forward in those people's cases. And then there's the last one, which is personal. And personal conversational style is valuing emotions more. So this would not do with your Sam Harris example, because he might not care about the emotions, and there might be huge emotions, as you might have said. It can be very sensational. And personal conversation style is where you pick up the vibes of the other person, and when you notice that they might not be feeling comfortable by the conversation, you'll let them take the position, maybe, and have them bring up their own mind. And yeah, the negative aspect, obviously, for emotional or personal people is that they might feel touchy-feely, and in a situation, a touchy-feely person might feel like not a person who should be leading, and that can be a minus side. So all in all, I think there's this need for maybe understanding what the four different conversation styles are, and giving room for the people who have these different styles or are good at these four different styles to take the position of the maybe leader of the conversation, and allow them to really flourish in their own way. And by all means, also trying to apply one's own conversation style to the conversation style that is useful for the situation. So in our podcast, for instance, we can improve our own podcast quality by not interrupting others, not derailing the conversation, and just getting huge monologues of something that might not be crucial to what the other person was presenting. And yeah, that's one of the
So is ways. It a good thing that we have huge monologues that are not relevant to the conversation, or a bad thing?
It can be either, because
depends on the monologue.
If the other person takes the monologue, and I think this is crucial, feels like the other person might be tiring and getting tedious, and then the other person might take the stage, so to speak, to ease out the other person, make it more fluid, for that it is an actual conversation and not a monologue, and that way let the other person breathe out and feel more comfortable about the conversation. And that's something that very much could improve like everyday conversation.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's interesting.
Yeah. And there's this dualism, or like divide between cognitive functions in any case, where one person might be a thinker and another a feeler. And
so are you destined to always have the same kind of talking style? Is that a personality kind of feature?
Yeah, definitely. I personally believe that everyone has a different sort of personality. It might not be that everyone has a unique personality type. That would be just, we're not everyone unique snowflakes after all. I think there are definitely divides between people. There might be a person who is a thinker and prefers to use a phrase like, I think this is the case. And then there is a feeler-based personality type where the person uses phrases like, I believe or I feel like this is the case. So that's one important notion. If you notice the other person uses one or the other term, then you can definitely already assess, if you so want, analytically what the other person might be like. And this goes a long way where you can understand the other person better as well. So there can be a huge mix between these personality types. Cool. You're not only destined to one, you can understand the other person, and you should always thrive to understanding them better.
And so in some context with some people, I may have one conversational style that is more that fits that one conversation better, and then in other contexts I might take another one. Is that possible?
Definitely, because I think language is always cultural, and cultures change even between one and the two persons. Yeah.
Nice.
Should we talk about something else, man?
Yeah.
Charge. What are you gonna make us talk about?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So, I've been bugged by Bart a lot over the last week to come up with a topic, and I was watching like presidential debates, the ones with Hillary and Trump and previous ones, and a lot of presidential elects talked about America being the greatest country of them all, or the most powerful country. I was thinking, interesting. And then I went on this clip and Putin talked about Russia being the most powerful country there is. And then I went on to, and I then read about an article how North Korea think it's the most powerful country of them all. And then I thought, what makes a country a powerful country? What is the meaning of a powerful country? Does it mean, you know, throughout history we've seen the countries like the Roman Empire was powerful, you know, in that time it was powerful. Before that, the Persians were powerful with their army and military. Then, you know, came the Spanish, Spanish Armada, which conquered a lot of the known world. Then came the British between the 1800s to the 1900s. And now many people believe it's the US or Russia, which is the most powerful country right now, and in the future it's likely to be China and India with the current growth economy and their military. And I was just wondering, what do you guys think makes a powerful country? And the first thing I think we could discuss is the public view. And when I say public view, I mean what our view is, and taking into account what the view of the people in that country is. So for example, North Korea, to us it might seem like, oh, they're not a powerful country, then, you know, most of the people are dying of hunger. But the public view within the country is that they're better off than anyone. They're the most powerful country. Whereas when you come here into the UK, you see everyone complaining about, oh, it's so awful here. But actually, comparatively and relative to another country, you would, if you said UK, North Korea, most British people won't say they're the most powerful country on earth, but North Koreans would say they're the most powerful country on the earth. So I'm talking about public opinion here. What do you think? Do you think public view matters, whether a country thinks they're powerful or not? Or do you reckon it's completely relative to every country for itself? What are your views?
Well, for power to be a relative thing would kind of defeat its purpose. It's yeah. When you say that this is the most powerful country on earth, it's about being more powerful than any other country.
Yeah.
We really have to define the word power here.
That's what we're trying to define. What do you think makes a country powerful? Because would you say power is their own ability to take over another country? So Russia can walk into any country and say, you know, we want this now, and it's country's ability to resist that, or do you reckon it's their own personal social standing within their and their own beliefs that makes them powerful? What makes a person powerful?
A position and positional power relation would be very geographical then. Like Russia is an enormous amount of land. Like it is the biggest or largest country in the world. And then compare that to the UK. UK is a big island on the sea. That's a very hard thing to fight against. Like Russia hasn't really had much luck with gaining routes to the sea, and that way have a big navy like UK does. So militaristically and geographically, those are very important matters. In the Second World War, if we talk about the power relations, China was being invaded by Japan to gain the enormous amounts of labor that they had. And Manchuria, which is in the northern bit of China, they had a huge amount of oil, I believe. And Japan was also trying to invade that and gain the energy. So one could probably say that having access to oil and coal,
so
like energy plants, would be powerful.
Well, that's a good point, because the BRIC countries of Brazil, Russia, India, China, they have like the natural resources, and that is why they're considered a powerful, like them four countries are considered powerful. But then I see a country like Bhutan, which is got, you know, basically no sort of need for criminals, but they're all Buddhist, and I would consider it a powerful country within the fact that they're so unified that I consider them powerful.
I take not a completely different view, but a view primarily coming down to if a country makes a threat to another country, they threaten to invade them or to take something away, they threaten to do something, if they are able to carry out a threat successfully, if they're able to successfully invade or overthrow a different country, that makes them more powerful than the other country. It's a very simple thing. So if Russia has a lot of land, that doesn't necessarily make it more powerful than another. It has to do with how good they are at guarding that land and stopping other people from invading them, and how well they be able to defend from other people invading them. If they can successfully stop other countries from taking their land, and maybe even one step further be able to invade other countries, that would put them in a position where they are the powerful one. And a country that just sits around and is maybe economically well off, but in terms of military can't do much, is relatively not a very powerful country. This is where I think of the Netherlands, where I'm from. I don't know, I can't say I'm very good at the history of these things, but during World War II, it really just sort of whatever the Netherlands did was based around the countries that surrounded it, what they were doing, because it couldn't go against them. When the Nazis infiltrated, they couldn't do much about what was happening. They just went along with it because they didn't have the military capacity to really stop or prevent an invasion. So they are relatively less powerful than Germany in that situation. Again, this is a very uninformed opinion of mine, but it's just as an example, that's how I'd see power.
Well, military-wise, China has the largest live military there is, but India has the most most people. This isn't excluding North Korea, which has, I think, an army of 10 million. I don't know how accurate that is. I think that includes basically a lot of their population, which aren't trained. But China and India have the most, the biggest number of men available to them for battle, but Russia and America invest the most. So what would you consider, like, let's say, for example, who do you think personally has the most powerful military?
Well, then you have to think also technologically, that maybe China has a large number of people, or maybe North Korea has this massive number of people with technologically far inferior weapons to utilize. And so in that case, then it would really be that Russia would be the most technologically prepared or superior army, or USA.
The USA has a large budget in their military. It's what 10 times bigger than the rest of the world?
You see, like, I don't know if the budget is that important. I'll tell you why. Because India, for example, they build all... I'm going to take a little bit to just go away from this topic and go to the space exploration. India survives on a minuscule amount of what US survives on. And they are, at the moment, a lot more successful than what the US are. So I don't think the funding is that important. For example,
well, they were successfully able to get a rocket in space and on a trajectory towards Mars on the budget of a Hollywood film.
Yeah.
Just completely crazy how efficient or effective.
I think the fact that the way GDP is growing, I read an article on this, the GDP is growing. India's military and space funding will be 50 times what it is now in the next 10 years because of the way the country is growing, which means that the funding within going into India for space exploration and military is going to be huge. And in fact, US has actually come out and said that they're now scared that India will actually beat US to Mars. Well, and
how do you feel about the... amount of super carriers the US have, air carriers.
Like,
I believe one of them has even a fusion reactor inside of it. Like, they have 20 or something.
Probably not carriers. Fusion, but fission.
Fission, yeah.
Fusion. they have a super carrier that has got technology that we haven't really been able to do yet.
Potato, yeah. No, I'm not very...
Same thing. It's just, but they do have a submarine that has a fission reactor in it.
Yeah.
And a water purifier and all these crazy things that it can stay underwater for years.
Still one of these super carriers costs like several billion dollars or something ridiculous, which is 10 times bigger than my own home country's GDP in a year.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And I don't think India still has that resource, especially because US have been in the game for a long, long time. And they've been building these throughout the last century.
But is it this one special supercarrier that they've paid a shit ton of money for that makes them better prepared than India? Or are they putting all of this stuff to waste?
US, in terms of... This goes to the point of allies now. US has a lot of allies and it funds. So when, you know, the nuclear idea was first came about, US decided basically who would get the formula for the you know, nuclear weapons, and they actually gave, you know, Pakistan a lot of help because, you know, Pakistan and India were in war, and they did not give, and they still don't give that much aid to India in terms of military. So the reason you can quite figure that they've got this $1 billion thing because India do not use any of the technology that US use. They build their own technology. They build their own nuclear system. They build... So, for example, right now, I read an article where they have now the most accurate nuclear missile there is. So they can basically pinpoint the exact place where they can nuke someone. And now they're talking about they want to put a satellite in the sky, which will have nuclear weapons, which will allow them to, what they say, destroy any sort of asteroids that... Because Earth is still not... resistant to, like, if there's an asteroid flying towards us, we're basically screwed. So what they're saying is, oh, we'll just put one up there and we'll protect the Earth from invasion. And then someone pointed out saying, why is the missile pointing towards the Earth? They're like, yeah. So, like, I think funding, because at the moment GDP, China's the way, the increase in GDP that China get every year is the same as the entire GDP of India. So at the moment, the money, I don't know whether you can look at money that much because technology, and that has to do with a lot of amount of money you have to pay the workers in US to pay. So there's not really a minimum wage in India at the moment. And you have to look at allies as well. So, and the fact that a lot of trading is done in US dollars, you have to also look into that for the point where you can't really say, I don't think, oh, this equipment's worth $1 billion, because you can have an equipment just as good in China, which is a thousandth of what that equipment is.
Well, the thing that you notice with the US and their equipment is because it's the government paying private businesses to do it, a politician or someone working in the government that is that is handing out the money to these private organizations. They're not handing out their money. They're handing out taxpayers' money. So there's a feeling that they have where they can spend this money more easily because they're not personally affected by how they spend it. So these companies, these private companies, can start charging a lot for something that isn't that valuable because they know the government will pay for it anyway. So you've got this massive inflation in prices for military weapons that you wouldn't otherwise have in India if India is doing all of these weapons and producing these things through the government themselves and not having this kind of private company idea where they get lots of profit. If the private company asks too much for a weapon, the government's not going to buy it. So it's tricky to compare just on the budget of a military, sure, because if one government is willing to dish out this amount of money on the military, then those private companies are going to ask that amount of money. And if you've got a company, or if you've got a government if you've got the Indian government that's not as much willing to pay that amount for military, then private companies are going to be charging less. So you can't, yeah, it's tricky to compare just on money.
Money alone, yeah. I also think, do you reckon education comes a lot into it? Because at the moment, you would say that the brightest mind in the world are coming from India and China, because the education system there, although has not got as much funding, but because there's such a mass population and the competitive nature of the education there, it's creating some of the brightest minds. So the technological advances will be a lot better for these countries in the coming years, because power, I think, is not just right now. I think power also includes this country's potential to do damage in the future. You have to also look at that as well as power.
But this is the one advantage where more money is more power,
yeah,
that the US have, is they rely on the education system in India to single out all of the best minds and to have them work on the rockets in the space exploration program in India.
Yeah.
And once they found these talents, the US will offer them 100 times or 10 times or 1,000 times as much money to do that same job in US. They come in to other countries and scoop out all the talent for themselves.
That's because
they have money.
That's true as well.
To sort of persuade them.
What that allows for is the fact that India, because of the population, don't have a shortage in this type of people. And as the economies are catching up, as India is catching up to the US, and in 2050, the GDP, India will have more as projected. The fact that there won't be like, this is like almost a chain of talent just coming in.
Mm.
And there will come a point where India will be able to offer that money, the same as the US. Because US can't, you can't always rely on other person's talent, because money is limited.
Yeah.
To a point, money is limited because you're paying.
And also, if it's not what, if people are not actually after money,
yeah,
and they're after something else, then the US can offer that.
Yeah.
For example, this is comparable to these big tech giants where these programmers are switching jobs a lot, going often to less paid jobs because they're just more interested. They have this perfect job at Google and they throw that away for a small startup that pays them maybe a tenth of the rate because it's more fun. And that would be the same with India, where the space exploration program in India is having so many more interesting things are happening there that even with massive sums of money, that wouldn't persuade someone to leave it.
Okay. What about the geopolitical influences the US have? You could almost say that the European Union is relying on the US with the NATO alliance.
Yeah.
Okay, that's an important factor. Like, the US is terrorizing Moscow by putting anti-air, and I use anti sarcastically here, is putting missile launchers very close to the Russian border, and there's some sort of terrorizing and maybe antagonizing of the Russia as well, right?
Yeah, but that's the talk about allies. But I want to talk about, like, when I'm talking about power, I sometimes don't see power as just the ability to attack someone. I sometimes see the power as, if, let's say, a country does attack you, your ability to take that toll. So, for example, if you pick 200 random Indians or 200 random Chinese and US attack them and they kill them. It's going to have, although it's, it seems kind of harsh to say, it's going to have a very small effect on the country itself. They're like, oh, you know, because of the population and the mass population. But if you pick 100 English people or 100 Americans and you kill them, it's going to send sound waves across the nation. So it's, I think you have to also take power as the person's ability to not only attack, but get attacked and come out, you know, standing up.
There's, yeah, you can go on about this and get look at it from different angles all the time. I think that's a very good point. It's you know, how much damage can you take without without giving up? Or basically, if one military is 100 times larger than another one, aside, if we just think separately from technological stuff, if they're allowed to take 10 times the amount of deaths of their military and still have a military left, that's one sort of hell of an advantage.
Because that's what Japan had in World War II. That's why US, like, that was the real key factor why they nuked them, is because they realized that Japan weren't giving up because them as a nation weren't affected that strongly by the deaths itself. The idea of giving up did not occur to them. So I think Japan itself is a powerful country. Maybe even more so powerful per person than the US at the moment, because Japan can take that hit, or the China can take that hit, and they can come out, you know, standing up.
And well, we never know, but it clear in this case, from what happened in the end, it took them two nuclear bombs. That's the amount of death toll they needed to then give up.
Yeah.
That's an insane amount. If only a fraction of one nuclear bomb would be enough for the British to be like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, if like there's a bomb that went off in any city, a major bomb, that would be for the Britain to like send sound waves across the entire nation to wake everyone up and just, you know.
Compare it to the Paris attack.
Yeah.
A couple months ago. That was 190, a three-digit number of deaths in Paris, of what was to be an even larger attack. That's what it ended up being. And that, you know, the consequences of that, you have, you know, Facebook going on about it for ages on end. And it was a very impact, sort of had a very large impact. Yet an equal amount of deaths happen on a weekly basis in other countries. And maybe that's our media bias to be just by nature, be more interested in what's going on closer to home than what's going on far away. But you can see that you know that's a trait that a country might have, that they're willing to, that the value of one life is less.
All right, I think that's enough for this week. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Three militaristic claps.
So guys, that was Red Swish the podcast, with me, Adamia, Bart, and Oiva. We'll see you guys next week.